My name is Ed Goldberg. Welcome to Author Author, an occasional series of conversations with authors touring through Portland or whom I have reached by phone. My name is Ed Goldberg, and I have the pleasure of speaking with Judith B. Glad. Welcome.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Yes. Have you endured the Jenny B. Good jokes your whole life?
Oh, all my life. Yeah, yes. Well, ever since I became a Glad.
Yeah. A Glad, yes. Yours are Judith B., though, right?
That's my legal name, yeah.
Yeah, okay. Judith is the author of Improbable Solution, published by GCT Incorporated from Aloha, Oregon, so a local author and a local press.
Yes.
Well, in the interest of full disclosure, you are also my publisher,
yes,
my online
publisher. Yes, I am,
publisher.
And I'm proud to be it.
Well, thank you. I'm proud to have you as a publisher. The title of your publishing online publisher is Unsealed Press. Can you tell us the derivation in the name?
Well, first I should say that we had a terrible time finding a name that wasn't already used. But Unsealed is essentially it's a script. It's now a typeface. It's what came after the Roman print. And most unsealed lettering you see is the Gaelic lettering, that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And we just thought it was an interesting name. And as soon as people started misspelling it and mispronouncing it, we wondered why we chose it.
Yeah, it's spelled UNCIAL.
Yes.
And the website is unsealedpress.com.
Right.
Yes, okay. This book, Improbable Solution, would you be offended in any way if I called it a romance novel?
Absolutely not. Okay. My website says I write romance.
Okay, so we're good. Because yes. I think some people, when they hear romance novel, you know, their eyes kind of roll back in their head. But romance novels are a real genre written by real people and have they're real novels, yes?
Yes, that's right. And actually Shakespeare wrote romance, as did Louis L'Amour and quite a few other people.
Yeah, and a lot of great crime writers started out as romance novelists, yes, as well. So I think the essence of all drama is conflict. And mm-hmm. There's conflict in crime novels. There's certainly conflict in romance novels.
Well, it's not much of a romance if there's no conflict, you know, because you've got, they met, they lived happily ever after. That's not just doesn't make a story.
Yeah, that's right. Cinderella, a classic,
exactly.
Right? Yeah, there's got to be something bugging them, you know, mm-hmm. keeping them apart. There's plenty of keeping the two in this apart. It takes place in a place called White Rock, Oregon, which is in eastern Oregon, somewhere near Ontario, Oregon.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a made-up place, yes?
It is. It's actually closer to Harper, which is not much more than a post office. It's east and a little bit south of Vail.
Okay.
And I chose the location because of the diatomaceous earth mines that are there.
Mm-hmm. Now, when I was in junior high school, which was in the Jurassic era, we learned about diatoms and diatomaceous earth. You hardly ever hear about it anymore, but it was at one time a very important ingredient in things like kitty litter, explosives, furniture polish. They all had diatomaceous earth in it. When I got my first microscope as a kid, we had diatoms to look at.
That's right.
Yeah, well, so why diatomaceous earth? What interested you about that?
Well, actually, I used to live in Payette, Idaho, which is just across the river from Ontario. And one of the places we took our kids, and I'm not sure why, was to those mines near Harper. Diatomaceous earth is like chalk. It's wonderful to carve. The kids had a great time with it. And I'd forgotten all about it until I saw in the Oregonian one day a little short article saying that the diatomaceous earth mines at Harper had been reopened. And I thought, well, that's interesting. And I just sort of tucked that clipping away. And the story just sort of came to me from there that what would happen if you put water containing organic matter in septic tanks, if you will, into diatomaceous earth, which is also organic, and would something strange and wonderful happen? And that was sort of the beginning of the setting for this story.
Yeah, I know I don't want to give too much away here, and I will allow you to give as much away as you like, but one of the very first things we see in the book is a prelude, and then there are, what are they called? There are little snippets at the end of each chapter.
Mm-hmm.
And they're written in, shall I say, an odd use of language? Is that a fair description?
Yeah, it is. It's someone who, or something that doesn't really know the language, but I had to make it so that a reader could understand it.
Mm-hmm. Also, has I think a mixed idea of what the human psyche is all about. Also, it's not a very good idea.
No, it's not. Well, you know, think about it. If you were an extraterrestrial coming in here and knew nothing about how humans worked, we are a pretty strange bunch. Mm-hmm. When you really think about it.
Yeah, I used to make jokes like guy from the gets out of the UFO and says, take me to your leader, and I take him to a Schubert concert. So
Yes, yeah. Exactly.
There are two people in this book about whom the book really centers. One is Gus Loring and the other is Sally Carruthers. And I thought, well, these are really two damaged people, but it's not. It's one damaged person and one conflicted person. Is that a fair description?
Yes, I think so.
Tell us about Gus Loring.
Gus was an engineer who was consumed with his job and neglected his family. He was married to a woman who was a ditherer. She didn't do the things she needed to do. And as a result, when she asked him to do something with her car that was not working well, and he kept putting it off, she died in an automobile accident as a result of the problem with the car. And he blames himself. Because it wasn't just her that died, it was their child. And he walked away from his business, which was a very successful engineering firm back east, probably Boston, as I recall, and hit the road, worked for a pittance wherever he went. He wasn't quite a tramp because he had a car and a microwave and a fancy coffee machine.
Well, there you go. What else do you need?
Huh? Yeah. But he took minimum wage jobs and would stay until restlessness got the best of him. He ended up in Ontario, got a job as a route salesman, deliveryman for a linen supply company. And that's what took him to White Rock, Oregon.
Mm-hmm. Now, Sally Carruthers, on the other hand, has a history in White Rock.
Yes, she was born there. Her family has been there since the late 1880s. They're the leading family in town, but she's the last one left. Her father is still alive, but he's demented.
And fading fast.
Yes.
Yeah. And she's there. I want to say each of them is doing penance in their own way. Gus is doing penance by living a life well below his capabilities and trying to forget. And she's doing penance for, I'm not quite sure what, but she's the one who's taking care of her father.
Well, I don't know that I really intended it as penance, but that's a good way to describe it. She feels she owes her parents. She nursed her mother until she died and was ready to go back to her life as a costume designer for opera, theater, that sort of thing. And then her father started showing signs of dementia. And she stayed because it was her duty, because she loved him, and because she felt that it would be wrong to put him into care, that this was his home. It's a nice big house, biggest house in town.
Mm-hmm. She's got a huge load of guilt on her back, you know, and she all through the book she keeps saying, I really should just put him in a home. And then the very next sentence is, all he did for me, and I can't do this for him. It's the classic guilt load.
I think a lot of people feel that way about their parents.
Yeah, I think so too. This cafe called the Bite a Wee Cafe in White Rock, Oregon. I've been to this place, not in White Rock, of course, but in small towns across America.
You have indeed, and yeah. So have I.
And usually when you go in, there's a whatever the cafe equivalent of a barfly is sitting at the counter, drinking their 19th cup of coffee for the day and schmoozing with everybody else. Mm-hmm. And it's where the elite meet to eat in this town. It's where everybody else meets
really
to eat,
too.
Well,
it's really the only place to eat in town. Yeah. White Rock is not very big, and it's a dying town. The young people leave as soon as they can. Doesn't even have a high school.
Yeah. They don't need one anymore.
No,
if it
not
ever did.
Really.
Yeah. When I was in Terre Haute, Indiana, 40 years ago, it was getting like that. All the young people were leaving, and the only people who left were pensioners. So,
well, this is true of a lot of little towns, particularly in eastern Oregon, but we've seen it in the valley here, too. This, people go to the cities, and the small towns languish. There's a number of settlements in the Willamette Valley that they're boarded up buildings or have been torn down that used to be towns.
Yeah, well, there are buildings in neighborhoods in Portland that used to be thriving businesses as well. Gus gets a new job. You contrive to bring him to White Rock to work. You want to talk about that a little bit?
Well, I'm not sure whether it was his doing or someone in town's or the entity that is known as White Rock. But he gets a job at the automotive sales, gas station, tractor repair shop, whatever you call it. And to be honest, I can't remember the name of it now.
Oh, I should have written it down, but I didn't. It's somebody's machine shop.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah.
And things work out so that he finds out about the job, thinks, no, I'm not interested, and gets laid off at the laundry, or the linen supply place. The same day, and he almost leaves, flips a coin, and heads I'll go north, tails I'll go south, and the coin rolls into a storm sewer. And so he doesn't know what to do, and he's essentially being manipulated, mm-hmm. but he doesn't know it. He never really accepts the fact that he's being manipulated.
And then he meets Sally.
He actually met Sally on his first day of delivery in White Rock. And when they first touched, it was like they'd both been walking across a wool carpet because there was a strong electrical shock between them, a spark.
So something passes between them.
Yes.
Best described as an electrical shock. And both of them immediately develop ambivalent feelings about that particular shock. Is that right?
Well, yeah, you've got to complicate a romance that way. But I think if I met a man and every time I touched him, it caused a spark, even if I was barefoot on a hardwood floor, I would be a little bit afraid of him. But at the same time, if he were a very attractive man, I'd also be a little bit attracted to him.
Relationships have been built on less.
Yeah.
I'd like to remind our audience that I'm speaking with Judith B. Glad. The title of her book is Improbable Solution, and it's published by GCT Incorporated. Judith, where can you get the book?
You have to order it because it's not published by one of the big presses. It could be ordered through any bookstore. All you need is the title of the author, and the ISBN would help. You can get it online at Amazon.com and probably a few other online ebook stores, although I haven't really looked, I have to admit.
Uh-huh. You haven't looked at your sales number on Amazon?
Yes, I've looked at my sales number on Amazon. To be perfectly frank, ebooks sell better than print.
No kidding.
And this is also available as an ebook.
Okay. Things start to happen to nail Gus's shoes to the floor in White Rock. One of them is the Mayfest, something to keep him there. What is the Mayfest? It sounds to me like the Rose Festival in Portland, but...
Yeah, it's a small town version of the Mayfest. Instead of the fancy floats that we see in Portland, they are built on flatbed wagons hauled by pickup trucks or tractors or whatever. But the big point of the Mayfest is for the kids of the town. They build a maypole, and the school kids dance around the maypole. It's an all-day thing. Sort of what I remember at some of the festivals we had when I lived in small towns in Idaho were like. And I think Hillsboro probably has something very like it, for instance, on their 4th of July parade, which is really a small town parade, even though Hillsboro is not very small anymore.
Yeah, people think of me as a New Yorker, but I actually spent a lot of my time in a small town on Long Island, and we had the firemen threw a barbecue every year on the 4th of July. One time they got trapped in front of their own firehouse and house burned to the ground because they hadn't made any arrangements with another uh-huh. fire department. So that was not good.
Well, small town festivals are really fun.
They are, and pretty much everybody looks forward to them for the whole year, and they plan for the whole year.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and Sally has a part in it, too. She's making what?
Since she's been in White Rock, she's been taking on odds and ends of sewing jobs as a costume designer. She'd naturally be very adept at sewing. And she cut the ribbons for the maypole, and she made the dress for the May Queen and her consort, all the time thinking that this is not a suitable dress for a 14-year-old girl, but she made it.
Yeah. Well, that's what else is going on these days,
that's
right?
That's true. Yeah.
Sally has a dream, or perhaps it's a vision. She doesn't know whether she's awake or whether she's asleep, and she sees something that I see am I drawing a blank here with you?
I'm waiting for you to describe
it. To finish. Yeah, okay. Yeah. No, I'm not going to describe it. You are. But can you tell us about Sally's dream?
Well, she's on a plane, just standing there, and on a road, actually, that extends into infinity in either direction. And people walk up to her, speak to her, and then walk off. And most of them go in one direction. Her father is one of them. I think her mother. But she gets the feeling that all these people are walking away from her are dead. And something happens that makes her realize that she has to go the other direction. She has to go back to life, and she has to start living again. She also knows that her father is about to die. This frightens her, it terrifies her, but at the same time, but if he dies, I'll be free. And this, of course, is the real source of her conflict.
And then, of course, Pop, as she calls him, gets worse.
Yes, he does. He has a stroke, he goes downhill, takes him a couple of months, but he just fades away into death, finally. Which, of course, frees her, but at the cost of breaking her heart, because she feels that she wishes him dead. Well, she did. After all this, she feels that the only thing that could be kind would be for him to die. But, you know, that's a hard thing to say.
Yeah. Yeah. Probably a hard thing to go through, too.
It is.
Yeah. All this time, as the story is progressing, Gus and Sally have been getting together regularly. Hooking up, I believe, is the current term for it.
I'm not sure what to call it. As good as any.
What they've been doing is having wild sex with one another, always with recriminations. Not always, but almost always with recriminations. Each of them has, I don't know whether it's guilt feelings or why am I doing this or should I be doing this.
Gus sees that as a trap, and yet he can't resist. I mean, the stronger his relationship with Sally becomes, the stronger the ties are that holds him in one place and keeps him from running, as he's been doing for the last few years. With Sally, she's afraid that will happen to her, that she'll develop feelings for Gus and not be able to leave White Rock when she is free.
Mm-hmm. He wants to leave, she wants to leave, yeah. And both of them are going nowhere.
Yeah, and you know, permanence would mean that they'd have to commit to something, and neither one of them feels ready to do that.
Now, you told us what was weighing down on Gus, and this is given to us slowly over the book. I was amazed that you gave that much away right at the beginning. But he tells her at one point, I killed my wife, and explains nothing. You know, like, did I strangle her to death? Did I beat her to death with a hammer? You know, what did I do? And But she just responds to it like, you couldn't possibly have, you know, meant any ill will. You know, she doesn't really even ask him about it.
What she says is, I think you must have had a very good reason.
That's right.
Yes. I couldn't resist that. Yeah.
Your idea of a little joke, is it? Yeah. I'm going to read one line from the book about Sally's relationship with Gus. It was one thing saying that all she wanted from him was great sex, but it was another thing entirely when that was all she got. This, to me, is like every woman I ever met in my life. You know, you have defined the duality of what women want from life in one sentence.
Well, thank you. I think.
Yeah, and I'm sure there are going to be women listening saying, I'm going to kill that guy the next time I see him. My experience over the years with women is that they do odd things to men by having, not really telling them what to do, and then finding fault with whatever we do.
I think you hit the nail on the head there.
It's a form of control, I'm sure it is.
Well, yeah, it's definitely a strategy.
Yeah. Having said that, the course of true love, of course, never runs smooth. And as we learn from what are called the intervals at the ends of chapters, whatever entity is involved in White Rock is working on strictly on a trial and error basis, yes?
Yes. The entity isn't sure what will make Sally and Gus stay there or even stay together, but it has realized, I'm not quite sure how, that it depends very strongly on emotional energy, I think it's emotional energy, from Carruthers, members of the Carruthers family who have been there for a century and more, to give it strength. And it realizes that if Sally leaves, it will lose that. It in fact, it feels a loss when she is down in the dumps. And it also feels that the combination of Sally and Gus, particularly when they have not necessarily sex, but a strong emotional reaction to each other, gives it strength. So White Rock, has to keep them there, has to keep them attracted to one another, and hopefully will get them to make new Carruthers, even if they won't be called Carruthers, to keep it alive.
Uh-huh. Then Pop dies.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so Sally is, quote-unquote, free. But, of course, she's not free at all.
First thing she thinks of when he's gone is, but now I'm free.
Yeah, but, you know, she's not free at all. And another interesting thing happens, and that's in the form of Aunt Trudy. Aunt Trudy gives Sally a journal. How much do you want to talk about?
Just that it's the journal that a grandmother, great-grandmother.
You say both, but...
Yeah, wrote that explains, or that tells about what her life was. And this grandmother was the only wife of a Carruthers ever to abandon him. She walked out, leaving behind two small children back in 1908, 1906, something like that. And this is the first Sally has seen of the journal. I just as soon not say what it says, but it sort of leads to how Gus and Sally solve the question or answer the questions they have about what's been happening.
Yeah, what she reads in it definitely influences the way she thinks and feels about her life and what's going on in it. Having once been a costume designer, she gets a job in Portland, or potentially gets a job in Portland, designing costumes for a modern dress version of Carousel.
Yes.
And so she leaves for a while. And this creates problems for both Gus and for the entity, because who knows what's going to go on, and maybe he thinks it's time for me to move on as well.
Well, one of the things that has happened through the book is there's a bronze elk in the park, and this bronze elk doesn't have any antlers most of the time, but sometimes it does, or at least Sally and Gus see the antlers on it. As soon as Sally leaves town, the antlers aren't there anymore. The town suddenly looks very shabby. And what it is that the entity has weakened with Sally's departure. So it becomes desperate, starts influencing them even more. And then Gus decides to leave.
Yes, interesting scene when Gus actually decides to leave. It's very, Kafka-esque? I guess,
oh,
in a way.
Oh, thank you. Well, he can't find his way out. And that's quite a maze of little roads back around the Harper-Westfall area. And I didn't have to invent the confusion he would have, except that he never could find the highway.
But there's a real Twilight Zone kind of a thing going on there, you know, because he knows his way around.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah,
he's been fixing tractors and balers and so forth all around the county. And so he knows where he is. But he can't find that stupid highway.
Okay, so we're at a point now in this book where I don't want to say anymore. Do you want to tell us any more about what goes on?
I would just as soon not, except that it is a romance, so you know it's going to have a happy ending. I don't think it's the happy ending that everybody anticipated, or that some readers anticipate. I tried to make it a little bit of a surprise, but you can't avoid having a happy ending.
Is that one of the conventions of the romance
novel? Well, it's, yes. And it also, I can't write a book without a happy ending.
Oh, good for you.
I learned that early on when I was trying to write science fiction and they kept getting rejected. And one day it dawned on me that they were romances, and that was in the days before science fiction had romance in it. So I have a whole shoebox full of rejection slips from those.
I should always keep them.
I do.
Yeah, they're a lot of fun. For my first book, I got 36.
Oh, I only got 23 before I started marketing it to ebooks.
Oh, well, you see, now my book was far worse than yours, obviously.
So. No, you were probably trying harder.
Yeah, maybe that's what it was. I've been speaking with Judith B. Glad. The title of her book is Improbable Solution, published by GCT Incorporated, a local press in Aloha, Oregon. Judith, what are you working on now?
Right now, I'm working on a Regency novella. I like writing Regencies because they're fun. They're sort of comedies of manners. The working title is Common Ground. It's about two people with similar interests that have to discover their similar interest. And this is in a time when science, archaeology, is more a gentleman's hobby and certainly nothing for a woman to do. Uh-huh. And that's their common interest.
Okay.
It's still in the planning stages.
Okay, well, when it's finished, you know, I'd like to talk to you about it.
Love to be here.
Okay, thanks very much.
You've been listening to Author, Author, produced at the studios of All Classical KQAC-FM in Portland. My name is Ed Goldberg. You can find these programs at our website, allclassical.org/author. Thank you for listening, and I'll be back soon.